Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. The political discourse that many people see ongoing here in this country seems to be something of a novelty. Not true. Those who study U.S. history, those of us who are history buffs, myself included, are learning that this country has had political discourse and great orators, great politicians, great leaders, for centuries, on and off. Which brings us to the topic at hand this evening, a new book that came across my desk a few weeks ago that I've thoroughly enjoyed, Salmon B. Chase, Lincoln's Vital Rival. And this is a book by a good friend of the station's author and historical biographer, Walter Starr. It talks about Salmon B. Chase, his early political careers, long before really working side by side with President Abraham Lincoln, but the discourse and the conflicts that this country was going through back then rival very much what's going on today. So what we do see today publicized in social media and newspapers and certainly on television isn't necessarily something new. It's just the way it's being brought into our homes today, and I guess maybe we see a whole lot more of it. But anyway, I want to welcome Walter Starr. Walter, nice to have you with us.
Great to be back.
Salmon B. Chase, again, just and step in here, but I just want to give people a kind of a quick description if that name doesn't ring a bell. A political figure, obviously, in American history, a man who worked very closely with Abraham Lincoln. In fact, was in the cabinet, a lawyer by trade. So he certainly knew his way around. But let me ask you, starting off, because you've written about other people who were part of that close-knit circle with President Abraham Lincoln. But why did Salmon Chase, why did he end up on the list and get the nod to put the book together?
I will admit, I wasn't initially enthused. I knew a fair amount about Chase before I started work on this book from my work on biographies of two other members of Lincoln's cabinet. But my editor, the late Alice Mayhew, said, I think there just must be more there if you dig in a bit. And as I started to dig in, I realized that Alice was right, that particularly in the years before the Civil War, he just, he's so many interesting places, starting as a very young man. When he graduates from Dartmouth, he goes down to Washington and studies law and spends his time hanging out in the Senate, listening to debates, and in the Supreme Court, listening to Daniel Webster and others argue cases there. Meets President John Quincy Adams within a few days of when he arrives. I mean, there's so many great characters for President's Day in the book.
Yeah, and the other thing that I was impressed about is, because he's not necessarily a household name. No, he's not Abraham Lincoln. He's not George Washington. In terms of, as I said, historical hits, household names. But the guy was, and again, talking about Salmon Chase, was not someone who was shy. He seemed to, one, his stance on anti-slavery at a time when, it certainly was not something popular throughout the country. Certain regions went along with that, but many didn't. But he wasn't afraid to make comments, put being quoted in local and regional newspapers about where he stood versus some more prominent politicians, right?
Absolutely. He was in terms of his legal work, starting in the late 1830s, and in terms of his political work in the early 1840s, was a kind of firm friend of Black Americans, not just in terms of speaking out against slavery in the South, but also speaking in favor of Black rights in the North. Giving a speech to a group of Blacks in Cincinnati in 1845, in which he said blacks should have the right to vote, blacks should go to school with white children, and then printing all that in a pamphlet so it becomes memorialized and becomes fodder for his enemies in future political races. He would face headlines along the lines of "Chase favors black and white children together in school!" ! As if everyone would understand. Well, obviously, we can't have Chase for our governor, but indeed, he wins a race for governor. Two races, actually, in Ohio.
And then his as you talked about being a lawyer, he took on some pretty notable cases representing the rights of African Americans at a point when really there was nothing on the books. There was very little support for that type of thing. So let me ask you about that, because slavery was, especially in the South, basically a way of life. Was he born and raised in an environment where they looked down upon slavery, or was it something that he adopted later in life?
Well, he was born and raised in your part of the world. I guess I can claim it as my part of the world, too. I was born in Massachusetts. He was born in New Hampshire, just across the river from Vermont. Not a lot of African Americans in rural New England, and he was born in 1808. Grew up there and also in Ohio. Went to Dartmouth. Again, it really doesn't kind of live in a interracial society until he goes down to Washington in his early 20s. And then he's living in a very Southern society. And his views on slavery at that point are sort of Southern views. In one letter, which I actually quote twice in the book because I think it's so important, he says that there's little cause for that sickly sympathy that people feel or affect to feel for the Southern slave, that really the people who suffer from slavery are the white masters who live in fear of their lives. So he doesn't start out as an anti-slavery activist. He has a kind of conversion experience, if you will, in his late 20s, early 30s, as he lives in Cincinnati and starts meeting folks who are anti-slavery or abolitionist, and meeting and working for these black clients who are in danger of spending the rest of their lives in slavery. So it's a little bit like representing someone in a murder case. It's almost life and death situation.
And these would have been, and are, I mean, even though the more often than not, the cases were not won, they were landmark in the fact that, very few people would have probably, very few would have taken on a case such as the ones he did, right?
Correct. There were not a lot of lawyers lining up to take on these unpaid pro bono unpopular cases. One of his friends wrote not long after his death that Cincinnati at that time was a suburb of the South, which perhaps a little bit of an exaggeration, but it is important to remember that you can look across the river from Cincinnati to Kentucky, and at that time Kentucky was a slave state. And so when the most popular novel of the 19th century, Tom's Cabin, is published, for him, he was reading about stuff he knew, fugitive slaves crossing the Ohio, frozen Ohio River, fleeing in hopes of finding freedom. Those were people just like his clients.
Right. And as you said, for no pay, so it had
right,
to...
For no pay. And so he takes on a few of these cases, notably the Matilda case, in which, again, he publishes a pamphlet. And so everyone knows what he's done in court in that case. It becomes a very useful kind of tool for other lawyers around the country who are a handful of lawyers taking on similar cases. And then after supporting the Whig candidate in the 1840 presidential election, he kind of hits his forehead one day and says, look, both the major parties, both the Whigs and the Democrats, are really kind of in the pay of the Southern slave masters because, you know, in order to be a national party, they can't really take a stance on slavery. And he joins this tiny fringe group of eccentrics called the Liberty Party and starts to try to turn it into something bigger that can, you know, actually begin to win elections rather than just have yard signs.
And, yeah. I got the same feeling. I got the sense that he was paddling upstream against the tide.
That is a great metaphor. Paddling upstream, maybe paddling, you know, as you sort of start to approach the Niagara Falls. You know, it gets real hard to paddle at some point.
But, well, you know,
I'm not quite sure where it comes from, but from a very early point, he has faith that it's all going to come out right. And I suppose in a part I know where it comes from his own kind of religious faith and
right.
knowing that, you know, things have been bad in the past and yet they come out right. He writes this thing that I quote at considerable length at an early stage called the Liberty Man's Creed, in which he kind of sets out in a few stark sentences, starting with quotation from Thomas Jefferson, who he always quoted, you know, all men are created equal. And then he sometimes goes on to say, and he meant all men of all colors.
I was very amazed by his, as you said, his determination, the never give up kind of attitude, you know, especially at a time when, you know, the tide wasn't going to turn anytime soon in his favor. I just want to take a quick pause and remind folks that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Voner, and this week we're speaking with our friend, historical biographer, best-selling author, Walter Starr. His new book is Salmon B. Chase, Lincoln's Vital Rival. And as we get into a little bit more of our discussion this evening, find out that the man that wasn't necessarily aligned with President Abraham Lincoln did become an inner circle confidant. But before that, Walter, you know, something else that you brought to mind, two things that stick out about Salmon B. Chase. And now I feel like, oh, yeah, I mean, this guy was a major national figure, you know, and today he probably would be because, you know, social media and the kind of media coverage that anybody gets today versus, you know, back in the 19th century. But two things, as you said, his religious virtues, his strong stance on religion, he wasn't going to bend one way or the other. But the other thing that impressed me, and I actually came away, you got to feel real bad, is that the man lost, he was a family man. He had been married, what, three times, lost two wives, lost children.
No, all three wives died.
Oh, all three. Okay. So three wives.
I was thinking about a comparison between him and a later figure, you know, who has biographies of his wives. There's no biographies of the wives of Salmon P. Chase because they all died so young.
Yeah.
These women die when they're in their 20s.
Right.
And then just to carry on, he had six children and buried four of them as you know, infants or toddlers. A number of them, you know, lived, you know, long enough that he knew their personalities and grieved them as when they died. Two children survived to adulthood. He was one of, you know, families in New England were large in those days. He was one of 11 children. And by the time he was in his early 60s, he had grieved the death of all of his siblings.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, death was, you know, did come more often in those days. But he was, if anything, you know, almost cursed, and yet sort of would rise up and carry on with his, you know, his both his family life and his outside life.
Yeah, I mean, it, like you said, I mean, that's what impressed me the most throughout the book is that time and again, you know, as you said, somebody close, a loved one passes away. You know, after a while, you would think it would derail anybody's ability to go, to continue through.
Yep.
And he seems to find this inner strength to come back. And you know, he said he probably had such a strong faith that really carried him through. But more importantly, again, would you call him? And I wanted to get your sense on this because I walk away and I'm thinking, okay, was he an intellectual or just someone that just could view life in a way that he learned that? I mean, was he an intellectual as we know it today?
Oh yes. I mean, one of the things that I couldn't believe it when I first sort of stumbled on this, and I went and I looked and I looked at it sort of three different ways to disappear in the newspapers. But while he was governor of Ohio, he took some time to do the research and went and gave a lengthy lecture on the subject of Galileo and the trial by the Catholic Church of Galileo. And he read in French and German as well as Latin. And you know, his reading would range from, you know, a recent study of Asia, which was at that time almost unknown, to memoirs of important historical figures, or he was an intellectual. Dartmouth can be proud of Salmon P. Chase, one. They can claim him as one of their most accomplished alumni.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to have done so many things at a time when, people think of the early to mid 19th century. Well, all they had was rural schoolhouses, and they were lucky if they could count to 10. But this man, as you said, graduated from college, but you know, self-taught in many ways too, though, right?
Oh yes, right. I mean, it continued to learn, and of course, there were many things that existed by the time he died that did not exist when he graduated from college. I mean, he lived through a time of incredible change, and you know, we think we're in a marvelous age that we have these new devices, cell phones, and so on. But imagine how one's life changed with the advent of the railroad. And when he first went to Ohio, it was basically a question of walking. Although he did ride, actually, on that first trip on one of the very first steamboats that went back and forth along the Great Lakes. But then, by the end of his life, could hop on a train and be get from Cincinnati to Boston to give a lecture, essentially in a little longer than it takes us today, but in less than a day.
Yeah.
It was, and he's part of that as well in a minor way in terms of, he serves, just to give his sort of four major positions in order, he serves in the United States Senate in the 50s with Clay and Webster and others. He's governor of Ohio in the late 50s. He's in the Lincoln cabinet in the early 60s, the Civil War year, and then he's chief justice of the United States from 64 through his death in 73. And in all of those four positions, he is, how to put it, in favor of the transportation revolution, and he does little things here and there to sort of encourage the technological revolution that's going on in his lifetime.
The four titles, the four positions and titles that he held would be remarkable even for somebody nowadays. It's an incredible amount of accomplishment. I'm sure you would agree with that. But at the end of the research, and I know you do tremendous amount of thorough research in writing these biographies, what for you stood out? I mean, not everybody is going to embrace Salmon B. Chase today, because I think, unfortunately, you know, history has almost become passé in so many ways in this country, and that's you know, that's an argument for another day. But let me ask you, when you got done with all the research, got the book finished, how do you view Salmon B. Chase? I mean, what does he represent for you in American history?
I mean, if I had to sort of, you know, name the most important thing that, you know, I want people to kind of think about if they see his name. And by the by, almost all of your listeners do see his name every day. The Chase Bank.
Right.
You know, whose credit card you have in your wallet, or whose, you know, ad you see as you drive down the street, was named in his honor after his death. It's not a bank that he founded or created.
Right.
A few friends created it not long after he died. But the one thing, if you sort of think of something, is, you know, a handful of people ended slavery in America, and he's one of them. And so we should recall that handful of folks, black and white, who struggled before the Civil War to build the political party that would ultimately, in a way they didn't envisage or hope for. They certainly weren't hoping for a civil war, but they were hoping and expecting and praying for the day in which there would be no slaves in America. And he lives to see that day,
yeah.
Which is, you know, an amazing arc of a life.
Yeah, and no question about it. And here we are in the midst of you know, Black History Month, so I think it's equally fitting, you know, that he becomes, you know, part of that whole assemblage of, as you said, individuals, both African American and whites, historical figures who laid the groundwork, you know, for what eventually became, you know, trying to level the playing field. I mean, there's certainly, obviously, a lot that still needs to be done. But, you know, I got to ask you this in the closing moments that we have. I mean, you could write about anything. Obviously, by now, I think most people would say, no, Walter Starr loves history. But more importantly, you become known as a renowned and best-selling biographer. Is it the inquisitiveness and the interest in historical figures' lives that grabs you?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I could try to write a book like about, I don't know, the election of 1896, or you know, some, you know, a general topic, you know, agriculture in the early 20th century. But I love people, and I love getting into the details of their, you know, complicated and somewhat contradictory lives, and then through them meeting other people, you know, the people that he, you know, meets during the course of his life, ranging from Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous French author, to Susan B. Anthony, the you know, early feminist leader. So I think that probably, you know, my next book and my next book, however many books I live to research and write, I have a feeling that they're going to be like this. They're going to be lives of Americans whose name we may vaguely know, but we, you know, don't know that much about them.
Right.
It's fun for me to do the research and get to know them better.
I love the way you put it, because it's exactly how history should be. We can talk about dates. We can talk about event that took place on any given date. But that's a time in history. Who was behind all of this? And I think it's interesting, as it is today, you know, looks back And, you know, who was this person? Where did he live? Where did she come from? Where did he come from? Were they married? Were they not married? Did they have kids? What were they like with their families? And that's what I found most enjoyable about Chase. I mean, ordinarily, if you just said Salmon B. Chase and, you know, like you said, the credit cards and the Chase banks across the nation. I've heard that name before, but this was so much more insightful, but it brings you closer to history because you realize that, you know, you day to day, the eating, sleeping, breathing human being that was Salmon B. Chase and the things that he brought to American history, brings it all to life. I want to thank my guest this week, best-selling biographer, historical biographer, Walter Starr. Walter, if people wanted to reach out to you directly, is there a website or an email?
There is. My last name is Starr. Kind of an unusual spelling, but it's handy for internet purposes. There's Walter Starr, all one word, .com, and there's a contact the author button there, and I get an email, and I answer them. So, if people want to reach me, that's the best way to do so.
And as in the closing few moments that we do have, as Walter has said, he is now living on the West Coast, but definitely a New Englander, born right here in Massachusetts. Again, the guest this week has been my pleasure to have Walter Starr on. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios of WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. And you can email me with any comments, questions, or feedback. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the Public Eye, thank you so much for tuning in.